Hello and welcome to Nightcap with Jim. I'm the titular Jim, and tonight we'll be continuing our series on my picks for most influential American directors, continuing on with Martin Scorsese. For more content you may enjoy, please check out our Morning Mugami podcast and our other social media content at Mugami Players on Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, and YouTube. Let's get into it. Alright, so I know any of you who listened to the previous installment of this series might have been a little bit intimidated by the length, considering it was my longest podcast yet, clocking in at an hour and 22 minutes, and I do apologize for that. There was a lot to get through when it came to Spielberg. Ironically enough, Scorsese has a couple more credits to his name director-wise, but I've cut them out because I just want to focus on his actual filmmaking and not, you know, the music videos he did for, like, Michael Jackson or the massive amount of documentaries he's done. So the list is actually a little bit shorter this time around, but I might be diving in a little bit heavier for some of these movies, taking a little bit more time on them. But then I'm not going to take too much time, because some of these are things that I would really like to dive into, do a deep dive on them, and give them their own individual podcasts. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. But anyway, to start out, I just wanted to name his short films that he did before he made his directorial debut, and then we'll go into, and we're going to be skipping around a little bit here, and I'll let you know why. But so we start off with the first thing he did in 1959. So this guy's been making stuff, motion pictures, for, you know, almost 70 years, which is pretty extraordinary. You know, or wait a minute, let's do the math here. 59, it's 2018. So yeah, 59, 69, 79, 89, 99, 2009, 60 years. Sorry, 60 years, my bad. I probably should have done the math before then, before just then, but anyway. So yeah, Vesuvius 6, the 6th, in 1959. Then on to What's a Nice Girl Like You Doing in a Place Like This in 1963, and It's Not Just You, Murray in 1964. Then he went on to make a couple of things, and his directorial debut was Who's That Knocking at My Door in 1967. And this was the, the first time that you really see his style start to form. You know, this particular project got him a lot of notice, because he did it, you know, around about the time that he, you know, was coming out of film school and, you know, forming the group that he did with, you know, like Brian De Palma and George Lucas and those guys. Well, not George Lucas, I don't think, but the New York crew, the Rat Pack of filmmakers, if you will. Unfortunately, followed that up with a exploitation film called Boxcar Bertha, which has a funny little story that I just found out about it, where he showed it to John Cassavetes, another great filmmaker, who embraced him and said, "Congratulations, you just spent a year of your life making a piece of shit." So, you know, not a stellar review. And now I'm going to jump forward a little bit, because this movie that he did in 77, I'm just going to end this segment here. So that's the start of his career, and then we're going to move on. Next segment coming up. Alright, so now we move on to the segment of his career I like to very humbly call the beginning of a legend. This, of course, starts with his 1973 film Mean Streets. Now, this is the first real gangster film that he did, and it was just the street guys. I mean, the lowest level dudes. It's brilliant. You know, Robert De Niro, in one of his earliest roles, you know, just kind of coming out of nowhere and just blowing people away. Harvey Keitel, you know, giving this really soulful, you know, really beautiful performance. Just all these great things. There's no original score, which is why this particular segment is preceded by the theme for Taxi Driver as opposed to a theme from Mean Streets. So if you are a fan of his gangster pictures, Goodfellas, Casino, Departed, so on, you definitely want to see where it all began with Mean Streets. Moving on from that, we have 1974's Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Now, I'm not going to talk about this one, really, because I haven't seen it, so you know about it now if you didn't before. And going on from that, but it is, from what I understand, a very excellent picture. And it's Martin Scorsese. So I mean, like, I'll be honest, you know, I'd recommend almost anything to Martin from Martin Scorsese's catalog to anybody, whether I'd seen it or not, just because I've seen pretty much all of his stuff, and it's all excellent. And I can hear Heath already just, "Oh my God, we get it. You love stuff." Yeah, shut up, Heath. So Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. And then we move on from that to 1976's Taxi Driver. Now, this is one of the most controversial and divisive films of the 70s. You know, something that really wound a lot of people up. And for good reason. You know, it's very dark. It's very, you know, it doesn't cater to anyone's sensibilities. You know, it really doesn't care, you know, like, what you like or don't like. It just is what it is. And it's fantastic. You know, I mean, Robert De Niro just going full tilt. You know, I believe the debut of Jodie Foster. And, you know, that's one of the things of controversy is because she was so young at the time filming this picture, and she plays a, you know, underaged prostitute. So, you know, some pretty dark territory we're going into, you know what I'm saying, with this particular picture. Some just fun facts. I'll probably, you know, repeat if I do a Taxi Driver episode all on its own, but just a little fun fact for you. De Niro actually, in preparation for this film, got a license from the Taxi and Limousine Commission in New York and operated a taxi for a great long period of time just to, you know, get himself into that mindset. And then he would have conversations with people from the Midwest and tape them so he could get his accent just right. And this is kind of like the start of when De Niro is coming into this, you know, really rigorous preparation before he makes, you know, a movie, so that his performance is going to be as authentic and believable as possible. Another little kind of fun fact for you, the ending of this film, the climax, after the climax, is inspired by samurai films of the time. I don't know if you know this about Martin Scorsese, but the dude is a walking encyclopedia of film. I mean, the guy knows just about everything there is to know about almost any movie you could possibly name, going all the way back to the inception of the motion picture. I like to think that, you know, the only people who know more about movies than I do are, like, actual film historians and the three filmmakers I'm talking about in this particular series. But if you put me and Martin Scorsese, you know, in a, like a movie trivia contest, he would kick my ass. You know, I mean, the guys, I mean, I just, the, I imagine, like, if he had an IMDb account, you know, and you went through, like, his ratings, you know, just, like, all the movies that he's seen, the list would just be, like, every movie ever made. You know, I mean, except for maybe, like, Michael Bay's movies. But, you know, he's just, you know, amazing like that. And so you'll see throughout all of his movies, you know, influences and references to, you know, completely diametrically opposed or, you know, just like something out of left field, you know, genres of things. And you'll just be like, you know, where did he, you know, where did this come from? And, but Scorsese will always have a reason for it. And, you know, he's just one of these incredibly visual directors who doesn't really do, like, you know, trippy, like, Inception CGI or, you know, Doctor Strange, like, you know, like, stuff. You know, he likes to do things in camera, pretty much, you know, all the time. Like, he really doesn't utilize digital effects very often, if ever, if he can get away with doing it practically somehow, some way. So whenever he does have these, like, interesting visuals, it's all stuff that's just, like, in camera, you know, just, like, some kind of a lighting rig or, you know, like, turning the camera this way or, you know, just practical things. And that just makes his film so unique in that sense of, you know, just relying none at all on the digital realm, which is really great. All right, so we're going to come back with a very interesting movie that you might not know that he made, and then we're going to come into his comedy years, and then we're going to backtrack. So we're going to go from 1977, jump to 82, 85, 86, and then we're going to swing back around and come back to 1980. So we'll be right back with that. All right, so this is a really interesting one that I actually didn't even know about until I looked up Scorsese's filmography for this particular series. He actually did the musical New York, New York in 1977, which is super trippy. Like, I just didn't know I didn't know he did this particular film. Couple of little fun facts for you. Robert De Niro stars and actually learned how to play the saxophone for his role, again showing that he's just super dedicated to his art. Pretty much the entire film was improvised by the cast, so, you know, ambitious as is typical of Martin Scorsese. But also, you know, and typical as well, because New York, you know, he's from New York. He's a New York filmmaker. He makes a lot of stuff about New York. So, you know, New York is definitely ingrained in his, you know, especially in his earlier work, which is great. You know, I mean, New York is just such an amazing city, and you can literally watch it's the city's evolution through Scorsese's pictures. You know, because especially, you know, from in the 60s and the 70s, New York was definitely not a very nice place. You know, drugs and organized crime and, you know, gang violence started, you know, there was an up, you know, the gang violence started to really become prevalent and a problem, you know, drugs, you know, with, you know, crack cocaine and heroin and cocaine. So, you know, you can really see the evolution of the city as well through his work, which is really super unique, you know, because there's not a lot of filmmakers that really lock in on one particular place, you know, one city or one state, you know, like a lot of us are kind of vagabonds, you know, we kind of nomads, you know, going from place to place, wherever this project works best. And, you know, there's not a lot of us out there that I know of that, you know, really stick to working in one place and portraying that place as the place that it is, because so often you see filmmakers going to, you know, Toronto or Ontario to film for, you know, for New York or Chicago or something like that because of tax incentives and things like that. But not Martin Scorsese. He's always, whenever he's made a picture in a place, he's always in that place, you know, typically. Which is just, you know, something I admire about him. Moving on to that, we're skipping ahead, like I said, to The King of Comedy. Now, this is a very interesting film. It's a dark comedy. More dark than comedy. Robert De Niro plays a, you know, an aspiring stand-up comedian, and all he wants to do is just do his act on, you know, this particular late night show hosted by Jerry Lee Lewis's character, and having Jerry Lee Lewis, or Jerry Lewis, excuse me, not Jerry Lewis, but, you know, having you know, a guy like that in this is just like a huge coup, and definitely just adds this something to it. Like I said, though, it's more dark than comedy, but it's totally worth it if you stick around to the end of the film, because, you know, it's something, you know. I don't really know what to say about it, because it's something. And then after that, we go to 1985's After Hours. I haven't seen that one either, so we're going to skip over that. And 86, we have a really interesting one. It's a sequel, which is weird, because, I mean, already at this point in his career, he's made so many amazing movies, and now he decides to do a sequel that he did not make the original. So, the original film, or the first film of this, you know, is The Hustler, starring Paul Newman. And the sequel, which Scorsese did direct, is The Color of Money, starring Paul Newman coming back as his character Fast Eddie, and Tom Cruise. And it's a movie about pool hustlers and pool players. I actually haven't seen this one either, which is kind of a bummer, because I'm a big Paul Newman and Tom Cruise fan, and obviously, because we're doing a series about him, I'm a big Martin Scorsese fan, so it's like, Jim, why haven't you seen that? But I'm gonna. Don't worry, I'm gonna. And this movie, I will say one thing about it is interesting, because this movie does take place in the earlier days of Tom Cruise's career, when he was an actor, you know, like he was an actor's actor, as opposed to what he is now, which is more of, you know, the big blockbuster action star. And there's nothing wrong with either one of those. You know, if you want to be, you know, like just a straight up dramatic actor, that's great. If you want to be, you know, the action star, and do these big blockbuster tentpole movies, that's great too. I mean, because I'm a huge Tom Cruise fan, and, you know, I love the Mission Impossible franchise. And I can't wait to see the new one. So it's like, but it's just interesting that how Tom Cruise's career, you know, kind of morphed and evolved over time. But anyway, enough about Tom Cruise. Back in time, we now come to 1980's Raging Bull. Now, I wanted to skip over this one and then come back to it, because I have a little bit more to say about this than the other films I've talked about so far in this segment. Raging Bull is amazing. It's one of the best boxing films of all time, but I wouldn't even necessarily consider it just a straight-up boxing film. It's more of just a movie that boxing happens to be a part of. And that's typically, I think, when a sport is portrayed the best, is when the movie's not necessarily about the sport itself. It's about the person, the character, who is involved in the sport. And then you just get a more honest portrayal of that particular sport. So if you don't know about Raging Bull, it's about the Raging Bull, Jake LaMotta, a very interesting character in history and in boxing history, and he definitely had a reputation. Again, Robert De Niro just delivering one of the, I think we can all agree he's given amazing performances throughout his career, but when you're talking about like the great Robert De Niro performances, usually people are pointing to the pictures he's made with Martin Scorsese, like Taxi Driver, Goodfellas, Casino, and Raging Bull. And Raging Bull is, there's a good reason why, I mean, the guy is just so dedicated to what he does, and Martin Scorsese is one of these directors that not only allows him his process, but pushes him to deliver, as much as he possibly can. And it always comes through, and Raging Bull is definitely no exception to that rule. All right, so a little bit of a break, and we're gonna come back, and we're gonna skip over, well, not skip over, but kind of gloss over, because I've already done a podcast about this next film coming up, and then we're gonna hit the 90s with Martin Scorsese. So stick around, you're not gonna want to miss it. Alrighty, so this next film I'm not going to be talking about really, just going to be mentioning it because I've already done a podcast on this, and that is Last Temptation of Christ, 1988. I will just say this: great movie, Willem Dafoe, great performance. I don't think I mentioned this, I don't think I brought it up on my podcast though, but it's one of these things that I feel like needs to be addressed sometimes. Because it's been coming out more and more in recent years, starting with Exodus, Gods and Kings, and that one about Egypt, which is the whitewashing of American cinema in regards to, characters who are most definitely not white or American. Last Temptation, I think, gets a pass because it's not just an all-white cast, it is a multiracial cast, and there are reasons for why character, like certain actors are in the roles that they are, and one of those is that the followers of Christ in the film are portrayed by New York guys, which again, staple of Scorsese's work. But he wanted them to feel like, street toughs, street guys, guys from the street, and then the Romans, portrayed by non-New York guys, so they would have a different vibe about them. And then throughout the movie there are Middle Eastern guys and stuff like that because this film was made in Morocco. It does bring up an in, that interesting sort of a, that. Well, not, I guess not interesting, but that sort of problem that Hollywood has with whitewashing. And it's definitely something that needs to be addressed. If I ever do an episode on, like Exodus, Gods and Kings, or, maybe I'll just do a whitewash episode someday so we can really dive into this particular topic. It's a thing and it's a problem, especially when you're talking about doing a movie about like Jesus Christ, because I mean, you can have your beliefs about, but the fact of the matter is, if Jesus was a real guy, which I'm reasonably sure he was, he's from the Middle East, and not a lot of blue-eyed white people getting born in the Middle East. So but anyway, moving into the 90s. All right, this is one of the best chunks of his career. I mean, to be fair, like they're all like the best chunks. This is just like this run of movies that he has in the 90s is just one of the best runs of all time. But then, when you come into the aughts, I'm probably going to say the same thing because the run he had in the aughts and the run he's having now in the teens, is they're just, you know, he's just on this incredible run of films. So we start with 1990s Goodfellas. Goodfellas, amazing movie. You know, Ray Liotta doing a kick-ass job as Henry Hill. Robert De Niro again, just delivering the hell out of it. And Joe Pesci, which is, if you know anything about the real story of Henry Hill, Joe Pesci is definitely not who you would think would play the character that he's playing, because the real life guy was, you know, like 6'2" or something like that, 240 pounds or whatever, and built like a brick shit house. You know, the guy is like an all-American linebacker-looking dude, you know, and Joe Pesci is definitely not looking like that. But his performance is so big that, you know, you forget about that. So, you know, it's just great performances means that, you know, anybody can do anything. Moving on from that, we come to 91's Cape Fear. Now, this one is really, really interesting because, again, it's not the kind of thing that you think that you would typically think of Martin Scorsese doing, because most of us, you know, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of us know him best for like his gangster movies, you know, for Taxi Driver, for Raging Bull, and you know, some of us for Last Temptation. But Cape Fear is definitely not the kind of thing you would think that Scorsese would do, but he did, and he did a pretty great job. I mean, I haven't seen the entire picture. I've only seen parts of it, but for a guy who's never really done that kind of special effects work before, he pulled it off pretty well, you know, and some really interesting performances from, you know, from the cast. Again, Robert De Niro coming back, so, and then Nick Nolte as well. So, you know, pretty interesting stuff. Then we come to 93's Age of Innocence. This is another one that I have not seen as of yet. And it's kind of a bummer again that Daniel Day-Lewis has decided to call it quits in terms of film acting, because this is one of two times that Scorsese got to work with him. The first time, in fact, that Scorsese got to work with Daniel Day-Lewis in The Age of Innocence. Then we come to 95's Casino. Now, Casino, I think I'm going to say it, is probably my favorite Martin Scorsese movie, besides probably The Aviator. It's just so good. And one of the things that kind of bothers me about it, though, is that nobody else seems to want to give it the credit that it's due. And everybody, you know, likes to bend over backwards, sucking on Martin Scorsese's you know what, when it comes to Goodfellas and Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. But no one wants to be like, yeah, Casino is amazing. I'm like the only cheerleader for this movie, and it really kind of pisses me off because it's just amazing. You know, it's this 3-hour masterpiece of Las Vegas organized crime influence. You know, that's just a story that we all should know about, because the story of Las Vegas is so much more than just this place where people go to lose all their money. You know, it was built on the backs of organized crime figures, you know, Bugsy Siegel and whatnot. And up until the 90s, you know, when organized crime finally got kicked out, which is what we see in this movie. We see the tail end of the influence of organized crime in Las Vegas. And then we move into this whole different era in the 90s, and then into a new era in the 2000s, you know. And Las Vegas has evolved so much over time that it's just you know. And then to because again, like I said, with Martin Scorsese's work, you see the evolution of New York in his New York films, and to, you know, to just get a taste of what Vegas was like before now and before the 90s, when it was still under the throes of the influence of organized crime. That's just so interesting, you know, to see this character who's, you know, just a really great gambler, being given the opportunity to run a casino is just like, what? Are you kidding me? You know, it's extraordinary, and it's just this thing that's just one of these great stories that just for some reason is flying under a lot of people's radar. So I'm hoping to, kind of boost its profile a little bit here. And then I'm definitely going to be doing a casino episode sometime in the future. So you're going to want to stick around for that. Stay tuned for that. And I'll let you know when that's happening because it's just such a good movie. And I'm really hoping that, with this, you get a little taste of my passion for it. And when I finally do a full episode on Casino, that you, if you, haven't seen it, that you will definitely be interested in checking it out, and hopefully will enjoy it as well. Then we come to another movie that I can kind of skip over a little bit, Kundun, because again I did a podcast on that a couple of like a month and a half ago or whatever. Great movie again, I just gotta say, and one of the most extraordinary aspects of this film is that there really aren't any professional actors. There's a couple here and there, but for the most part, it's all non-actors, which, if you watch the movie, makes it even more of an extraordinary ride because the performances are amazing. I mean, they're incredible performances from these people who have never even been in front of a camera, much less, never even seen a film camera, much less been in front of one before. And it's amazing, it's absolutely incredible. And then the story of the Dalai the Dalai the blah 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 blah, the story of the Dalai Lama is absolutely just one of the most incredible stories you've ever heard. It sounds like something out of, like a myth or a legend. And I just want to send all, as many good vibes as I can out to the Dalai Lama and Tibet, because, I mean, not to piss off the entirety of China, but I kind of feel like Tibet's been getting a raw deal, almost for, like 100+ years. That's just my opinion, but I'm gonna take my personal shit out of it anyway. It's a good movie though. Check it out. Then we come to the final 90s movie, Bringing Out the Dead from 1999, starring Nicolas Cage. And this is one of these times where Nicolas Cage is one of these actors that he can deliver an amazing performance. It's just he's got to be paired up with the right filmmaker. And this is one of those times where he definitely brings the thunder, and delivers a pretty dope performance. He plays a member of the EMT member of an ambulance crew, and it's a pretty intense, very visual, very trippy movie, because it's a lot of in his character's head, Nick Cage's. It's a lot of in his head stuff, so there's just a lot of interesting visuals and stuff like that going on, which is just really, really interesting and just kind of whoa, So yeah, it's something that's, I mean, I will say this though, Bringing Out the Dead, it's definitely not a movie for everybody. It's one of those, not everybody's gonna like it, but even if you don't like it, I think you could still appreciate it. Just like the technical aspects, the performances and the cinematography and, so on and so forth. Viewer's discretion, you know what I'm saying? Dealer's choice, that kind of thing. Check it out if you want to. I would recommend it, but like I said, it's not for everybody. So we're gonna take a quick break, come back, talk about the aughts, and then we're gonna move on to the 2010s. So, stay tuned, please. All right, so now we come to probably my favorite decade so far, and that's the aughts, the 2000s. And we start with 2002's Gangs of New York. Now, this is the beginning of one of the most epic collaborations in film history. Obviously, one of the others being what we've already talked about, with Robert De Niro and Scorsese starting in 1973 and coming up to 1995. But now we start with Leonardo DiCaprio and Scorsese's epic run of collaborations, starting with Gangs of New York. And Gangs of New York is pretty amazing. I will say this, a little bit of a criticism on the film. not a huge fan of Cameron Diaz. You know, she's aight, you know. I just don't know if she was the right choice for Gangs of New York. I think there's some other actresses that probably could have done it, you know, a little bit better or even a lot better, but that's just my opinion. Daniel Day-Lewis, of course. I mean, you know, you can say what you want about the movies he's done, but you can never deny the excellence of his performances. That would just be irresponsible. So, you know, and then getting him, opposite, in a, you know, opposite DiCaprio is just like, whoa, you know what I mean? And it's interesting, again, because now we're going, now, you know, we're having Scorsese telling a story about New York and having to go back in time, and it's the one time I can think of where he's making a movie about New York, or a New York tale, a New York story, where he's not filming in, you know, New York City proper. And, you know, for good reason. He can't, because all of these places have been torn down. you know, and then rebuilt. So that's interesting. But it's a very interesting thing, because these are, you know, not gangs that, in the modern day sense. These are, you know, old New York street gangs, and that doesn't even just necessarily mean the criminal elements. That also includes, you know, like police and fire, because at the time there wasn't really a centralized, you know, especially with the firefighters, there wasn't like a centralized, you know, firefighters union or whatever, you know, like there wasn't like a central firefighter government sort of thing. So you would have, you know, groups of firefighters getting into fist fights outside of a burning building, you know, while the thing's just crumbling into ash, because, you know, they're like, you're on my territory. No, you're on our territory. Blah, 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 blah. You know, just acting like dumbasses. So, you know, very volatile time in New York's history, way, way, way back when. So it's a very, very interesting movie, definitely, and it shows New York in a very different way, and, you know, not the most flattering light. It's very, 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 very interesting, very cool movie. And then from that, we move on to 2004's The Aviator. Now, oh, I love this movie so much, and again, I can hear Heath going, Jim, we get it. You like things. but what can I say? You know, go to hell, Heath. it's just so cool, you know, the story of Howard Hughes, you know, his earlier life up until just, you know, up until the point where he takes the Spruce Goose out for its first inaugural and only flight. And it's a pretty intense, you know, life that this guy led. I mean, dude was a straight up genius when it came to getting what he wanted, you know. I mean, this guy made Hell's Angels, and he did it all 100% practically, with real planes, real pilots, and to the point where, you know, these stunts were so incredibly dangerous that a number of airmen died making this movie. And, you know, you think about that now, and, like, if multiple people died on a filmmaker's movie, that guy would probably get thrown in jail for, you know, like, negligent homicide or something like that. But back then, you could get away with doing these incredibly dangerous stunts like this. You know, I mean, you just go back and look at, like, Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton's work, and these guys, you know, back then, these, you know, filmmakers were doing these incredibly dangerous, insane things that nowadays, you know, only Tom Cruise would attempt, you know what I mean? And it's just, it's mind-boggling, you know, if you actually go back and watch the Hell's Angels film, it's just like, I mean, it's breathtaking, but at the same time, it's like, ooh, this is way too dangerous, way too dangerous, you know, if you're like an actor, you know, and you're like, yeah, I could do, like, Tom Cruise stuff, you know, if you watch, like, Hell's Angels, and you're like, yeah, I could do, like, I could go back in the 1930s and do stuff before they had wires, watch Hell's Angels, and you'll just be like, nope, I can't do that, I'm not gonna do that. So, you know, and then you move on, and he's building planes, and, you know, just all this amazing stuff and making and you know, producing more movies and, you know, doing some really controversial things, especially in his movie career, you know, doing stuff like The Outlaw, which there's a very funny scene in The Aviator where, you know, the Motion Picture Association is, you know, trying to ban his movie because of the actress's breasts and how they're, you know, prominently displayed, quote unquote. And so you have this whole scene where he's, you know, just like this whole, you know, line of pictures from other films showing other actresses, quote, mammaries, and it's just like so absurd, you know, and that, you know, just nuts, things like that. And then, you know, some of his crashes and his relationship with Katharine Hepburn and, you know, these other ladies. And Kate Blanchett, like, oh my god, she is so knockout amazing in this movie. I mean, just, I mean, I'm a huge Kate Blanchett fan, but, like, this is just one of those, like, exceeding expectations kind of performances, you know? Which, I mean, to be fair, she kind of does that a lot anyway, because she's that good. But, you know, when it's like, you know, you can be the greatest actor there is, but, you know, your performance is going to suffer if you're not working with, you know, a professional that's going to push you to really, you know, push you to push yourself. And that's the kind of director that Scorsese is. He's the kind of director that wants to get the absolute very best out of his performers. And, you know, and it's weird because he's not, you know, because some directors, they have to do weird things, you know, like, or like, just like, dangerous things, or, you know, just, you know, stuff like tricks or, you know, whatever. But Scorsese just has to be like, man, let's try it again, and you know, and then Shazam. So you know, he's just this very, you know, he's very low-key. He doesn't have to be like, you know, or anything like that, like aggressive or like trying to trick you into doing something or like come up with like a mind game or, you know, like be aggressive and, you know, something like that. He's just like, let's try it again. And, you know, and he just gets this stuff. And then we move on to 2006, The Departed. One really killer movie, you know, just really kick ass. Just epic, you know, one of the most epic cop crime movies, you know, cops and criminals movies ever made, with just this just incredibly amazing cast. You know, DiCaprio, Mark Wahlberg, Matt Damon, Martin Sheen, Alec Baldwin, James Badge Dale, Anthony Anderson, Jack Nicholson. I mean, just the list just goes on. And, you know, some amazing music from Howard Shore, but also just some amazing music that Scorsese picked out, you know, like Gimme Shelter by Rolling Stones. And I'm not a huge Rolling Stones fan, and, you know, Gimme Shelter is kind of this song that's like, you know, I can, you know, it's all right. I'll listen to it every once in a while, but its placement in The Departed is, mwah, it's perfect. And just all these other, you know, like, and I don't really care for the Dropkick Murphys at all, but if you're listening to this on Anchor, you will have noticed I put the Dropkick Murphys song from The Departed to precede this segment. So, you know, just things that I'm not really huge fans of, I enjoy immensely in this particular picture. And what an ending, too, you know. And that's going to do it for this segment. We're going to come back after this to talk about the 2010s. And this is, you know, again, just, and, you know, just these runs that he's had, this run that he's had throughout his career of just, like, there's not really any duds. You know what I mean? And it's just fantastic. So take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about 2010s. Stay tuned. Come to the 2010s, and we start with 2010's episode one of Boardwalk Empire. Boardwalk Empire, what a show. I have not finished it as of yet. I only got to a little bit through season two, but that's just because, you know, those kinds of shows are a little bit tougher for me to, like, really binge watch, so I haven't actually watched Boardwalk in a while, but it is a great show, definitely worth checking out. Another gangster project, and it kind of a little bit bums me out that Scorsese only directed the one episode, but it's a hell of an episode, so, you know. Then we come on to Shutter Island in 2010 as well, and this movie really, really trips me out, you know, really makes me think pretty hard about some stuff, just like psychological trauma and things, and how people deal with said trauma, because it's a tough movie, man, you know, it's really dark, it's really intense, and, you know, part of that is just because it's filled with all these amazing performances, you know, from DiCaprio, from Ted Levine, Mark Ruffalo, Max von Sydow, you know, Jackie Earle Haley, Michelle Williams, just all these great performances, and some really incredible special effects that kind of came out of left field, because, like I've said a couple of times, Scorsese is not the kind of guy who does a lot of visual effects stuff, you know, and he doesn't really do that much in Shutter Island, but, you know, there's some stuff, but it's amazing. And, you know, it's just him, again, just pushing, you know, like I said, he's the kind of director that is able to get the very best out of his actors, make them push themselves, to deliver, and he does that for himself, you know, he pushes his own limits, his own boundaries of what he can do, and just, you know, keeps expanding his range of talent and skill, you know, with every movie, it seems like, you know, he just keeps doing all this different stuff, and it's just a really exquisite movie. Then we come to 2011's Hugo. Now, I haven't seen this one in a pretty long time, probably since about 2011 or 2012 even, but it is really great from what I remember. Very different, again, just not the kind of thing you would normally think of when you hear the name Martin Scorsese, but great a movie all the same, you know, very, very unique, very different for what his usual fare is, but again, that's just what we think of, you know, when you say the name Scorsese, again, you think of Taxi Driver and Raging Bull and Goodfellas, Gangs of New York and Aviator and Departed and Shutter Island. You don't think of, you know, New York, New York, or The King of Comedy or Color of Money, or Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, or Age of Innocence, or Last Temptation, or Kundun, or Bringing Out the Dead, you know, or Cape Fear, or Hugo. You know, it's just one of those things, but like I said, like, all these movies, like, so many different things are happening throughout his career, all these different movies, all these different things. I mean, you know, one of his first movies was an exploitation film, and, you know, so it's just like, this guy has had a very wide and varied career, a lot of different stuff, and Hugo falls into that category. So definitely I would recommend checking it out, and, you know, I'll probably talk about it again sometime on the podcast once I've had a chance to rewatch it. And then we come to 2013's Wolf of Wall Street. This movie is pretty messed up, I've got to say. The life of Jordan Belfort is... what the hell? you know, this guy just led his life is like the pinnacle of the lifestyle of excess. You know, just like guy who has way too much money, does way too many drugs, gets way too fucked up, you know, has way too much sex with way too many people, you know, just all this just it is the top of the mountain of excess, and it's pretty messed up, you know, like. But you have some amazing performances, you know, Jonah Hill coming back and just reminding everybody that he can act the pants off of a, you know, a performance, you know, I mean, quite literally, in this particular case. you know, and Margot Robbie, I mean, oh my lord, Margot Robbie is just exquisite, you know, I'm a huge fan of her work, she's just amazing, you know, absolutely incredible actor, just an immense talent, you know, absolutely amazing, and I would very much consider myself lucky and blessed even to get the chance to work with, you know, someone of her caliber, you know, someone of her, Jonah Hill or Leonardo DiCaprio's caliber, because these guys are just amazing, you know. And then we got John Bernthal in the mix. If you don't know the name, you might recognize him as being Shane from The Walking Dead, or he is now currently the Punisher in Marvel's The Punisher Netflix original television series, which I'm a huge fan of. He also had a little part in Baby Driver, a little bit of a part in Wind River, you know, and he's just a really great actor, you know. I think I'm a huge, huge fan of his. I really hate Shane from The Walking Dead, but you know, once he got past that, then I started to like him, because you know when you see an actor and you only see him in the one thing, and you kind of associate them with that character. That's kind of how I feel John Bernthal had it, until he really started getting all this really diverse work that he's gotten in recent years, you know, since he left The Walking Dead, because, you know, I mean, I don't think any of us like Shane from The Walking Dead, he just sucks. You know, but anyway, you know, just this, it's, you know, just an amazingly well-made movie, but again, just like the pinnacle of excess, and, you know, definitely a very cautionary tale. Like, that's the thing about all of Scorsese's, you know, gangster pictures, or crime-based pictures. It's for him, it's all about the rise and then the fall. You know, he doesn't just show the rise, he doesn't just show the fall, he shows both. So that way you can go on the entire journey and be like, this is great, we're having so much fun. Wait a minute, we're not having fun anymore. Oh, we're really not having fun. No, nope, this is bad. Oh, crap. so he's all about, you know, showing, you know, the rise and then the consequences of those actions, which I think make him a very kind of a moral voice in terms of depicting, you know, criminals and criminal activity, and just, you know, people in general. Finally, we come to Silence. Now I did want to do a podcast about this, earlier, but you know, circumstances prevented me from doing it. You know, it's an amazing movie, you know. I'm not huge on religion, I'll be honest. This is definitely one of those things that, you know, kind of, you know, it definitely makes me think about stuff. You know what I mean? Like, not necessarily in the sense of religion, but just in the sense of morality. And I just love Andrew Garfield's performance throughout the film. It's extraordinary. The guy just flat out can act, you know? And, you know, I've been a fan of his since the beginning, since, you know, Social Network, which is really where he made his breakthrough. And then, you know, I'm actually a huge fan of his portrayal as Peter Parker, Spider-Man. I love Amazing Spider-Man 2. Just a quick note on that. I don't understand anybody who says that movie is, like, indecipherable or they can't follow it. There's too many characters. I'm like, it's a superhero movie for one thing. And by the way, The Avengers Infinity War has got, like, 121 speaking parts. So it's like, if you can follow Avengers Infinity War, but you can't follow The Amazing Spider-Man 2, maybe you're the one with the problem, not the movie. that's just my two cents. But, you know, Andrew Garfield, he's just amazing in this movie. So is Adam Driver, Liam Neeson, All these amazing performances, and it's very, very dark, this movie. It's just really intense. And here's the thing I'm going to say that's a little bit controversial. I can see from both sides of this thing. Now, if you don't know what Silence is about, it's about a pair of Jesuit priests played by Adam Garfield. Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver, who come to Japan just before the Western influence started to take hold over the country, and so this is a time when foreigners, were not really allowed in Japan. Before Westerners even started, I forget his name off the top of my head, which really sucks, but this particular admiral, he showed up in, Tokyo Harbor, or Kyoto Harbor, of one of the major cities, and, he just, fired a couple of rounds, fired a couple of cannonballs out, and was like, hey, guess what, you got like a day or two to figure out whether or not you guys all want to die, because we're coming in. And before this happened, especially, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years before, foreigners were just straight up not allowed on Japanese soil. So if, especially like samurai or, military ruling class or whatever, found, a foreigner on their shores, just straight up execution right then and there, because they just didn't want any outside influence. And and so when we have these Jesuit priests and these other sects of Christianity, these other priests coming in and teaching the word of God to the Japanese, the government is none too happy about it, and so I can totally understand, the point of view of the priests, wanting to spread the word of God. I do think, however, it's incredibly ignorant and arrogant to think that the word of God is the only true path of righteousness. I think that's very dangerous thinking, and it's the kind of thinking that gets us into religious-based conflicts like the Crusades, or, the whole Israel and Palestine thing. And that's why I can see the Japanese side of it, which is they want to persecute anybody who's practicing Christianity. Now, I do not agree in any way, shape, or form with the methods that the Japanese use in this film to discourage the practice of Christianity and encourage the practice of their religion of choice. But I do understand where they're coming from, where it's like, we just want to do our thing, and we don't want you encroaching on that. And one of the biggest arguments for this is actually in the film, and it's that the Japanese don't actually understand and can't quite comprehend what the priests are attempting to teach them. They don't actually understand these religious beliefs that they are being taught. For instance, God, to them, the way that they visualize God is he's the sun. I mean, literally, a star in the sky. And the problem with that is that if, Jesus is God, Jesus died to, sacrifice himself and died for your sins, he's gone, though. But if they conceptualize Jesus or God as the sun, he rises every day. So it's just something that completely detracts from what these guys are trying to teach them. And so I see both sides of this, this thing, this conflict that's going on in the movie, and I think that's how it was meant to be portrayed through Scorsese's direction in this film, because he doesn't just show the religious side of, like, the Christian side of it. He shows both sides' arguments for why, you know, they should, you know, why they are right, or, you know, why the other side's wrong and stuff. And, you know, so it's really kind of, it's the kind of movie that definitely makes you question your own personal choices in life, your beliefs, your belief system even, and your morality, you know, like, is it right to come into a foreign land and force your beliefs on another people, albeit gently, you know, but still with that mindset of this is the only thing that's right. Everything else is wrong. This is what is right. And is it okay for you know, those people that you're, that are being influenced by this outside influence, is it okay for them to say, look, we just want you to leave, go away, and let us do our own thing. We have the right to live our life the way we want to without you saying that we're going to go to hell or whatever, that we're going to be punished because we don't follow your particular system of belief. And then, you know, what's the line? You know, like, is, like, because it's, I mean, because for me, I think it's totally wrong what the Japanese do to these, you know, practitioners of Christianity. You know, part of that's because I'm American, you know, and I do believe in freedom of religion. I believe in the Constitution, you know, I believe in freedom of religion. So, you know, if you want to practice Christianity or Judaism or, you know, you're Muslim or, you know, whatever, you know, Hindu, Buddhism, Taoism, whatever. I don't really, you know, it's not up to me. I don't get to choose what you do or do not believe in. You know, if you want to be an atheist, be an atheist. If you want to be agnostic, well, you can kind of, I wish you weren't, but, you know, I mean, but, you know, I don't get to choose what other people believe in, and I don't really want to, you know, because I feel like that's when you start crossing into really dangerous territory. So I have, you know, I believe what I believe, and I really don't want to try to influence what others do. And that's why this movie kind of gets under my skin, is because I can see it from so many different angles, you know, like, because the thing is, like, these people that, you know, especially early on in the film, that these two priests are interacting with, it seems like they are making their lives better. But that's only from one angle. You know, from another angle, they're making their lives actually worse because they have to practice in secret. You know, and then, you know, one of the things that's, you know, so intense about this movie is this idea of having to deface the image of God or Jesus in order to escape punishment, especially punishment by death, and you know, to see Andrew Garfield's character be put in, you know, be captured by the Japanese and be put in these situations where all he has to do is just put his foot on an image of Jesus or God, and then it's all gravy, you know. To me, it's like, that's just this kind of thing of, like, what is more important? Protecting this image of your savior, or protecting the actual human lives of your followers, of your congregation, you know? And that's, again, another, you know, very moral, bind, pickle, you know, that is explored and fleshed out in this movie. So it's a very heavy movie, you know. I mean, I definitely wouldn't recommend it to everybody, just because, like I said, it can be incredibly violent at times. It's very dark, it's very tense, it's very intense. There's a lot of emotional and traumatic events that happen in the film, and you know, it's definitely not for everybody. You know, if you're going in looking for, you know, a movie that's going to give you hope, especially hope about religion, you're not going to get that from this movie. So, you know, it's definitely not like, you know, a Passion of the Christ, where it's like, or a Last Temptation of the Christ, you know, where it's like, yeah, there's all this bad stuff happening to, you know, Jesus, but, you know, when we come out on the other side, it's all gravy. It's not like that at all. You know, again, viewer discretion, you know, I'll leave it at the viewer's discretion about whether or not the audience's discretion about whether or not you want to check it out. But, you know, I mean, I think it's an amazing movie. It's definitely one of my favorite movies because of how thought-provoking it is. But it's pretty intense. So, you know, you just got to know that going in, that you're not going to get what you think that you're going to get from this movie unless you think you're just going to get a whole lot of dark, really dark stuff. So, you know, just so you're forewarned, because, you know, like I say, you know, I don't want, you know, you guys contacting me talking about, "Oh, Jim, your recommendation was crap, man. You should have told me more about the movie." And, you know, so I try to give you as much as I can, so you're not shocked or surprised or disappointed or let down or enraged or anything like that. Like, you don't have super negative emotions because of, you know, me not telling you enough if I recommend a movie. But anyway, so that's it. That's all of Scorsese's movies up to date. So that's going to be our show for tonight. Thank you so much for listening. Please tune into our morning show with Heath and our other social media content at Manga Me Players on Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, and YouTube. Thanks again so much for stopping by for a nightcap. Good night.